All right. So yeah, it's great to be here as I was yesterday. I just there is really quite a lot to say about confirmation variability. So I just wanted to touch on certain things, and especially the way we can address it. But I wanted to start first with telling you about a recent result, and they were all the result of exploration of the whole reconstruction strategy, and we called it internally higher resolution project, you know, because we were optimistic that we would get somewhere. And now we have put a number on this, and the number is 6.7 angstroms. So I just wanted to very quickly go through this. The strategy was to use a small data set of 50,000 to optimize the processing, because we didn't want to spend a lot of time with a large data set. And the parameters of image processing was sampling, because we had a high resolution version with 1.7 angstroms or so. And the idea was that in the initial stages of refinement, it was useless to work with such large data sampling. And so the idea was to first use coarse sampling and switch over to fine sampling. The question, of course, was, do we even need to go to fine sampling in order to exhaust the information? So that was part of the questions. Window size is an important consideration, because we are using CDF correction at the very end rather than at the beginning, which means that we carry around the information that is contained in ripples around the images, and we have to be careful not to cut off these ripples, because otherwise we make mistakes in the CDF correction. So the question was whether the window size needed to be increased in order to avoid this effect. Angular spacing was an issue, and then some of the people recently have used amplitude correction in each step of refinement, instead of at the very end. And the question was whether that was a smart strategy, because there's obviously the concern about noise amplification. In the end, the final parameters that we wound up with and that we applied to the entire data set of 130,000 was that the angular step of 0.5 degrees was used, and an angular search range of 2 degrees. So in other words, we made a switch in the middle and then confined any changes to 2 degrees. And then 7 iterations of refinement, which consumed 922 hours on the 48-node cluster. The regular window size was okay. We didn't see any difference. The sampling, you know, can be switched midway from coarse to fine, but we actually needed to use the finest sampling in order to exhaust the information. Now, there were all of a sudden resolution measurement issues which, you know, caught us by surprise. We found out that in order to make any reasonable comparison, we had to apply a soft mask to the reconstruction to get the true resolution. Otherwise, we found that whatever we did had very marginal influence on the reported resolution. So it turns out that there is clutter around the reconstruction, which produces a large amount of inconsistency, and that is reported in our usual resolution estimation. So we have to get rid of this, and it needs to be done by a soft mask, because we don't want to introduce additional resolution, which is artifactual. And then we have evidence for the dependence of the resolution as measured by angstrom to the minus one versus log n. It is a linear dependence between resolution and log n. And again, we were very surprised by this, but apparently it comes out, and it comes out in, you know, for a different data set. And the question is the lin-log dependence general? And so it's sort of an appeal to everybody to find out with their own data whether we have some kind of a mysterious law here. And then the question is it allowed to extrapolate from the half to the full data set? Because we always make an resolution estimation by splitting the data set in half, and then so we strictly get a report only on the half of the data set. So with the discovery of this Lin-Log dependence, the question arose, you know, could we simply take this curve, which seems to be, you know, behaving so fine, and make an extrapolation to the full data set, which is, of course, gives us a better resolution. And then when we get that better resolution, we have to just look, you know, what is it real? Is the stuff that we see real? So first of all, the clutter here, this is really pretty horrendous. By lowering the threshold a little bit, you see the clutter outside. And so here are the results. The red curve is when we do a resolution estimation on the entire volume. And this the green one is when we use a Gaussian mask. And the blue one is the curve that we get for looking at the resolution of only the clutter, namely the stuff that we have excluded with the Gaussian mask. So it's a very bad resolution. And since the area is so large here, it sort of drags the resolution down.
What's the dimension of this structure
here? So this is 250 angstroms in diameter.
So is 0.5 degrees search enough, fine enough, theoretically given the size?
Well, it we didn't get any improvement beyond that for these data. Now the clutter. If you think about this, the clutter is really the result of the superposition of the different projections, and you know what it's doing in the background, and in a way it is a unique signature of the precise geometry, and it's unique. It's a unique geometry. It's a unique set of samples of angles, and my point is that set of angles is different for the two half-set reconstructions, obviously, as no angle is exactly duplicated. So this information here is strictly the worst reproducible. In this whole data set. So it makes a lot of sense that one has to throw it out in order to get any real information from the interior. So I can't go through the details, but this is the kind of documentation that we've done for going through the various steps of the procedure. And then we always look at these Fourier shell correlation curves. So this here, in the end, is a small angle refined map of 300 by 309 array, and we call it high resolution. And this is the final curve right here. So this is what the data set looks like. This is now for 7.5 angstrom resolution. And in a moment, I show you a 6.7 angstrom resolution. It is of a complex that we know to be unusually stable. It's with the ribosome bound with a ternary complex formed by amino acyl tRNA, EFTU, and GDP in the presence of chiromycin. This is what our EFTU looks like, and the various tRNAs when we just take the small subunit away. And here, to sort of give you an idea of the quality of the map, here we have the X-ray a structure of protein S2 represented at 7.5 angstrom resolution. And you see every single detail of this structure right here in the at the periphery of the map. And the only thing that is missing is this helix here. It must have been floppy, and so it doesn't show up. So now this is the extrapolation. So the half set is 65,000. We see this completely straight line here by simply taking smaller subsets and making resolution estimation as normal. So we just ventured to extrapolate this to 130,000, and then we get this 6.7 angstrom map. Now we don't see evidence of artifacts, and we can now look carefully and compare this with the X-ray information. So just before I show this, I just wanted to show you this Lin log behavior. I just before I looked at this here, there's something wrong with the scale, because these data by Scott don't extend to 3 angstrom resolution. There's something wrong. But nevertheless, the data fall on a straight line. Here's the original ribosome data set without the soft masking. With the soft masking, it becomes a completely straight line. The GROEL data that were made available by Scott and by Bridget and Clint, when we take the sevenfold symmetry into account, 14, right? But we use 7 here. I think we asked you that question. But anyway, maybe 14 gets it closer even to this here. And the astonishing thing is that we have a Lin log. We seem to have the same slope, and we are really talking about completely different image processing, completely different data, completely different structure. So what is going on here? It's like a Max Planck constant.
Is the slope always the same?
Well, we have only these two here. We have only these two data sets, and so I'm that's why I'm wondering if anybody has. Put together data like this. I'm really curious, and I'm curious what the reason for this behavior is. So this is the 6.7, and that is now compared to the 10 angstrom which we had published earlier on. You can see the increase in the definition of the various features, and of course the sort of exploration of the map is still going on right now, but now you can. Compare the various features as we see in cryo-EM and X-ray. So to some extent, there are some conformational changes involved, but there's a pretty good comparison. And here's the definition of the domains of EFTU. And that, of course, that's biologically very important, because the EFTU domains make an adjustment depending on the tRNA that is present, and it is also it's at a stage where GDP hydrolysis has already occurred, but the entire structure is arrested in the GTP information conformation. So the question is, what is going on in this at this intermediate state? Just as an introduction into looking at conformational changes, this is just the elongation cycle, and the biggest changes that are taking place are during the translocation and the decoding process. Translocation is characterized by EFG entering in the GTP state, and then it essentially displaces the moiety formed by A and P, so tRNA and mRNA, and they sort of move jointly over by one codon. And one wants to understand this process. And that now evidently goes along with a large conformational change in the ribosome that we've been fascinated by for some time, and one of the conformational changes is called the ratchet motion. So now I just wanted to make one point here. We draw inferences all the time from static pictures, from 3D snapshots. So we compare EM maps in different states, and then we essentially say, well, you know, how does it get from here to here? Evidently, there is a movement, but we cannot observe it, but we postulate that it exists. So even though that it's pretty compelling, one still wants to have experimental evidence of the actual movement that occurs. So we have in various from various other places, we've gotten confirmation. For instance, we have seen a move of the L1 stalk. We have obtained confirmation from X-ray crystallography. We've seen the head rotation for the small subunit. Again, there is confirming evidence from X-ray crystallography. In fact, Jamie Cate got fortuitously an X-ray structure of the 70S ribosome, where two ribosomes were in the same unit cell in different conformations. And the conformation, the main change in conformation was the rotation of the head. And I'm even more excited about the conformations that come from FRET studies. So we have the ratchet motion that I'm going to talk about in a minute was also observed with single molecule FRET as well as with bulk FRET. And then there is a process of tRNA selection which has also been observed by a single molecule FRET. So the ratchet motion induced by EFG binding. With cryo-EM, we see differences between conformations in two different states, and we also see evidence of conformation variability. When we don't go through classification, we essentially leave the two populations coexisting, and then we see evidence of blurring. And then there's also three-dimensional variance reports that something is going on. Now, for the ratchet motion, there is an experimental evidence from hydroxyl radical probing. There are changes of lead-induced ribosomal RNA cleavage pattern along elongation cycle that was already discovered in 2000 by the group in Vienna. And then most recently, there were studies by bulk FRET and single molecule FRET, both involving Noller's group, where we very clearly see the distance changes that are expected exactly from the cryo-EM experiments. So I'm going to show that in a moment. So what we observed is simply that when EFG binds, in the GTP state, that is by using GDPNP and without involving GDP hydrolysis, we get this kind of change in the position of the small subunit. And at the same time, the EFG changes structure. If you fit the X-ray into the EM map, it doesn't fit by a large margin, and one has to make a conformational adjustment. So this is a typical example of an induced fit because both ribosome and EFG undergo structural changes such that the best match between the two, between the molecules occurs. And the purpose of the ratchet motion can be rationalized as the need to take the mRNA along with a small subunit in this direction. And then, so we have to postulate that there is a lock between the mRNA and the small subunit, and the lock needs to be opened then, and the mRNA stays in place, and the small subunit moves back. So that's how we sort of get the mRNA moved by one, by one codon. The reality is a little bit more complicated, involving the rotation of the head and so on, but I have to leave it at this for the time being. Now it was really fascinating to see in our studies that that the ratchet motion occurs everywhere in all phases of translation. So it occurs in the in translocation, but it also occurs when IFT IF2 binds in the initiation. It occurs when RF3 binds during termination, and all these are GTP ACEs, but it doesn't need a GTP ACE. It also happens in the case of binding of ribosome recycling factor. So it seems to be a movement that simply is being used liberally in all kinds of different contexts to achieve a certain functional result. And we have modeled this. We use a flexible modeling by real space refinement in order to show what is happening in the underlying structure. This we call a quasi-atomic model. It just is essentially sort of a sketch of what is happening on the molecular scale. So this enables us to look exactly, how the context changes and how the different atomic contacts change. And so just to drive the point home that we are dealing really exactly with the same movement, I have put side by side the atomic models that we got for EFG binding and RF3 binding. So essentially the motions are very, very similar. Questions so far? Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question. there's an X-ray structure and you have these EM structures. Is there any way of checking, when you do docking into an EM structure, whether, how accurately that docking is, in particular whether the interfaces between different parts, different domains, is faithfully done or not faithfully done, or if we want to use docking to generate sort of atomic models, you'd like to know how accurately they really are. We've all done them.
So the question is about the accuracy of these models, and in order to really make give a true answer, we would have to have experiments from a completely different methodology. So you would have to have X-rays or so, and show them side by side. What we can only say something about is the precision with which we can do that and the reproducibility. And so this we did in the case of one structure, which we did repeatedly, and we did repeatedly the whole specimen preparation, electron microscopy, reconstruction, and real space refinement fitting. I don't have the slides here. I have them somewhere else in another talk here. But at the end, we just put them side by side and color-coded the RNA according to the RMSD between equivalent sites. And so that gave us confidence that anything that is larger than 2 angstroms is definitely significant in terms of the reproducibility. But we cannot say whether this is the actual structure. And you raise another good point, which is how genuine can we, what kind of confidence can we place on the juxtaposition of atomic contacts. And there's, we can now go, you know, one by one, we can look at the plausibility of these. And this is a very tedious thing, which we have done in some cases. There's one thing that I should have thrown in, which was very convincing. There, when you look at the ratchet motion, you see that there are two proteins essentially are juxtaposed, and they are S13 and L5. So for the two different ratchet state, they are in different positions, like this, like so. And then if you look and flesh them out, you know, from this model, from the atomic model, then we flesh them out and make a full van der Waals representation, and then look at the charge distribution. And it was beautiful to see that for one of the states, for the most stable one, you get an electrostatic, you get antipolarity, and for the other state, you get the same polarity, implying that there you get some kind of gliding arrangement. So there's you know, when you look at individual ones, then with some grain of salt, you find things like this. But I don't know whether we can really trust every single contact. Yes. We haven't gotten the 3D variants to work. We're waiting for a documentation from Powell. So we'll I will tell you.
Have you any idea to the speed of that motion? Because I'm interested in if I could understand that PRNA selection might be determined by the latching
from dichotomy, so staying time. So, yeah, well, we have no data on this, and maybe the FRET data from NOLA will tell us something about it. But we only look at the two different snapshots.
So I have a quick question.
Yes.
About the ratcheting motion, do you know any details how the mRNA is locked and released?
Oh, right. How the mRNA is locked and released? Well, we know how the mRNA is locked for a cognate codon anticodon situation from Venki Ramakrishnan's study. There are three bases that somehow lock in place, and they recognize a Watson-Crick helix. And so when you have the presence of Watson-Crick helix, then they lock firmly in place and cause a change in the whole decoding center. So we know that mechanism. Now, the other mechanism was more obscure. What is the nature of the process that unlocks this? But we know now that GDP hydrolysis produces a conformational change in EFG, and which brings the tip of EFG in close vicinity to this to these bases. And we have postulated that this is the nature of the unlocking during translocation, and we have this. We have put this in a paper that was published earlier in EMBO Journal, Taylor et al. So here is evidence for the conformational changes. They are periodic changes that were discovered by Polacek and others in Bartas group. So there are changes in this. Pattern of RNA cleavage during the elongation cycle, so which tells us that what we observe is something real. And the other one is Ermolenko and others, 2007, it was published, I think maybe it's Molecular Cell. This also, you know, gives us a beautiful representation of the ratchet motion from Nola, using his model. He has, let's see. Here, sure. Sure. Here are the placement of the fluorophores. So this fluorophore is attached to the large subunit, and the two flanking ones are attached to the small subunit. And the idea is that if the redshift motion is real, you would get anticorrelated distance changes between L9 and S11 on the one hand, and L9 and S6 on the other hand. And so that's sort of very clever, and this is exactly what's shown here. And these are bulk FRET studies that show these anticorrelation very strongly. And then he also did single molecule FRET studies that show the same effect. And there's then along with this came an experiment also by Noller's group also recently, in which he simply put a link between L2 and S6 across the subunit interface to find out whether with a link like this translocation would still work. So he had a translocation assay which is very sensitive to the production of more polypeptide and the movement of the mRNA, and so they discovered that when they have put this cross-link in place, all translocation activities cease to exist. So from that, they know that the ratchet motion is necessary for translocation. Now just looking at all these results, and the results from the binding of the other factors, I was tempted to introduce this idea of macrostates of the ribosome. It has two macrostates with distinct conformation. And so along with the change in intersubunit angle, a structural reorganization takes place, which affects the properties of several sites on both subunits. And my thinking is that the ribosome really is transformed into a different molecule. It switches over. It switches all its characteristics. And that apparently is important in order to make these functions possible, and they both appear to be separated by a very small energy barrier. No GTP hydrolysis is required to go from one to the other, and so and first of all the transition is instrumental to translocation. And then, as you can see, the binding of variety of factors causes the same effect. And then what is very intriguing is that spontaneous ratcheting along with the transition to this to a particular hybrid state of the tRNA has been observed by Harry Noller in the absence of EFG. The ribosome apparently is constructed in such a way that it switches, that it is able to switch between these two different conformations fairly easily under the thermal conditions. And so this, I didn't put this down here, but this you can put in the context of the observation of factor-free translation. Because translation occurs with much lower rates, but in the total absence of factors, so there must be something in the way the ribosome operates that makes these processes possible. Yes.
So in a field of ribosomes, do you find the two configurations if they're that close together in energy? You should get
Right, that comes right next. Yeah, we always find them together. Yes, in fact, that was the essence of the next slide. The two populations coexist. One is non-ratchet plus A, P, and E in the canonical sites, and the second is ratcheted, and it has a hybrid PE state and EFG bound. So we always have the need for classification. Now, we have made use of supervised classification. Then, of course, it's like cheating. We have to know what we're looking for. This data set has now been used in order to develop various ways of doing unsupervised classification, because that's apparently, obviously preferable. We don't want to, always know what we're looking for. And unsupervised classification, requires no or minimal prior knowledge. There's the maximum likelihood by Searle's shares that we've already talked about before. And cluster tracking, I wanted to introduce very quickly. And then there is a third one, which might not be widely known, Mirek Kalinowski, who worked as a graduate student with Gabor Herman, and they did an approach of graph cutting. And that is very impressive, but it has only been demonstrated for a phantom data set so far. So these are really the two states, non-ratcheted and ratcheted. and they exist in roughly, one-fifth or one-fourth is in this conformation, and all the rest is in this one here. So I just wanted to explain what is happening with the tRNAs. When the tRNAs goes to the ribosome, it goes like this here. First of all, the nomenclature. The first letter is always the position on the small subunit. The other one, position on the large subunit. The letter T has been invented to denote the bound with EFTU. So we have AT, AA, AP, PP, PE, and EE. And to look at that graphically, it goes like this. Okay, so that's how the tRNA goes through. with cryo-EM, we've seen the PP, AT, and AA, and also the PE. And the PE comes from the observations that I'm right now talking about. So now supervised classification. We applied a trick here because we just wanted to have some kind of an independent evidence of what is going on. So as a reference, 1 versus 2, we didn't use any factors bound or tRNAs bound. All we did was we changed the conformation. We used conformations of the ribosome, either ratchet or non-ratchet. So that's the only. And then if the classification works, then independently the tRNAs would pop up at the right places, and EFG would pop up in the right condition. And that's exactly what happens here. Okay, so the. The data that are closest to reference one, to this unratcheted state, all have show AP and AP and E, and the one that is closest to the ratcheted ribosome shows the extra EFG and the tRNA and the PE state. So that gives us confidence that we don't just create. These facts by this kind of classification. We really have this with completely independent evidence. So this is just another display, but this time we look at it from the top. But I'm showing you this now in order to juxtapose it with the maximum likelihood classification by the group in Madrid. Which we've performed on the same data set on 90,000 ribosomes. So you can see that it's exactly the same situation. For some reason, this was done with 5, and this here with 4. The 5 only comes from cutting the correlation histogram into 5 equal parts. We could have used 4 here. And you can see that in this case that the histogram doesn't show any evidence of an sort of a saddle. It doesn't show any evidence of separation. So the data are just not good enough to be to show up here as separate groups. Yes, yes. It's simply correlation versus reference 1 minus correlation with reference 2. So here's the juxtaposition, and then since we already we know the identity of each particle and where it falls, we can really now see how many have been grouped in this way. And so the count is 11,400 out of 15,000 here and 19,000 there. So it's a pretty good overlap in the accounting for this class. So I just wanted to, yes? I'm sorry.
In this overlap there.
Yeah.
For the maximum likelihood classification, I thought that the particles are not, you know, they are members of many different classes. Not only 100% member of one class and
not the others. Well, I don't know the details, but I think there's simply a cut. Is necessary. One has to make a final decision at the end.
From reading their paper, when the signal to noise ratio is good, it's pretty clear to which class something belongs. So they just took the class that had the highest probability.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thanks. So I just wanted to talk about cluster tracking, another cluster tracking method, or a cluster tracking method for classification. The idea is the following: we in Fourier space, if you look at the projection in a particular direction, and then you could look at it in an adjacent direction, and if you are within the resolution domain. You will have a certain amount of overlap, and that's the whole justification for 3D reconstruction, that you can really draw from data like this. So you have an overlap, which implies that there is a correlation between the data. So if you go close enough in angular space, then you always have correlation between data, which means that there is similarity, So the idea is now cluster tracking is that we classify data first in two orientations on an angular grid in a normal way, and then classify all data falling in narrow angular neighborhoods. So each of these crosses here is simply a sampling point in the angular grid, and there's a certain amount of data have been assigned to this, you know, it's like 200 or 500 or whatever. And then we simply take a generous circle around this point and take them, take all these data and analyze them. Analyze them for variability. And we do this by multivariate statistical analysis. And multivariate statistical analysis is very smart in detecting or variability that is associated with orientational change, okay? So multivariate statistical analysis then detects changes in orientation, and it detects changes in the membership, you know, in the classes. So now the idea is, first of all, implicit in this here is that if we have clustering at a particular place here, then and we move over from here to another place, then these clusters have to be continuous. Okay, so they have to when these points are close enough together, there's a continuity constraint for these clusters. And the idea is all we need to do is track the clusters all along the globe or the half globe, and then we are all set. Then we have, you know, these are, you can think of them as some kind of data sheets, which are solid, and we grab them and say, well, this is one cluster, and then there is another cluster which is somehow has a different topology. And the objective of these methods is to track these. So if for a given angular neighborhood, we do a multivariate statistical analysis, and then we get both factors that are associated with orientational change, which we don't want. They are trivial. We want the ones that are not associated with orientation. So we exclude the ones that have to do with, and then we do clustering in the remaining factor space. And then we slide the angular neighborhoods along the half globe, so we until everything is covered. And then we track the clusters as we go along. And we did this with phantom data, with signal-to-noise ratios of 0.1. And you can see the quality of the data here. You can also see that even with higher signal-to-noise ratios, you are unable to tell whether something has an EFG or not associated with it. So this is really a test under experimental conditions. And this is the data. The 90,000 are distributed like this. Red means that it's very highly populated, and blue is that it becomes very sparse. So obviously, from this diagram, it's clear that we're gonna have a tough time in these empty regions here. The method's gonna work very well here in these very fat islands, and then the question is how to connect the islands. Okay. Yes.
I'm puzzled. But can you go back to the slide?
Yeah. Oh, you're very far away there.
I mean, I can clearly see the particles there. So, I mean, that looks more like what I would call an SNR of one. So I'm just wondering how do you define it?
Well, it's defined in the normal way, as the ratio of the variances. It's the squared quantity. Yeah.
Power.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
You have quite a large box there, so there's quite a bit of noise coming in where there's no particle. So is that counted in the signal to noise?
Yeah. Right.
It is. So maybe half of the area has no particle. I mean, if you made the area this big,
right,
you'd have an enormous signal to noise, but it wouldn't.
No, you'd have it very small.
Sorry.
If we were small.
You'd put in a lot of noise and
right,
the signal would be constant. So
yeah.
Maybe that's part of the, that'd be a sort of a factor of four, I guess.
Well, as far as I know, the signal to noise is computed for the corresponding bandwidth. So we don't go all the way out. And maybe that answers your question, right? Because it doesn't make sense to go beyond the resolution that we can possibly get from the data. Just to summarize here, what we get the result that we have a large contribution from orientational changes, and then in this phantom. Computation, we actually see the appearance of the angular clusters in factor space. So that pop right right, out like this. So by this process, we can eliminate by just looking at the histograms in the factors, we can eliminate non-trivial factors and simply focus on those factors where we can expect clustering according to conformation. So these are the kinds of histograms, and then we need statistical tools which Ji Fu now used in order to make a determination whether a factor is a genuine factor or whether it belongs to changes of view. So we are just sort of in the process of going into experimental data and then going all around the globe. So the problem is of course the discontinuity of angular distribution. This first solution is sort of trivial: collect more data, collect a massive amount of data. The other solution would involve cross correlation of common lines that Ivan Nogales was talking about, because all we need is to know something about the islands, and then now we have to connect the islands, and we can connect them by this common lines procedure. So I think I'm sort of talking about all kinds of other issues that might not be so relevant, because when you have a ribosome, conformation changes are going on all over the place. And one fascinating subject is how the tRNA goes into the ribosome. And you've already seen a poster earlier on by my postdoc, Shabir, who is present here, to compare the different tRNAs as they come into the ribosome. And that entry of the tRNA along with EFTU is accompanied by a very large conformational change of the tRNA. And that's sort of a fascinating detail all by itself. But I think I should just simply stop here and so that we have a little amount of open questions.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, I think this clustering method by the Spanish group addresses this very easily. Yeah,
it's a continuum,
and then the data is sort of split in a very natural way among all the different bins that you provide to the algorithm. In essence, it's like the averaging problem. You want to average over a certain angular group of views, and then you have to make a decision on how to divide
the
it.
Trade-off then,
yeah. Right.
I mean, I guess for every example is going to be different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, Scott. Yes, yes. I was wondering how do you have any thoughts on this behavior of your data? I mean, the way the data were plotted were really sort of unfortunate in the paper, because it goes like this. Because if you use the real space resolution, and then the linear number of particles, then you don't see this behavior. And we discovered this Lin log completely by accident. And then we rushed to your data. Yeah. Oh, okay.
1,000 times.
Well,
not 1,000, but, you know, we're trying to explore these questions.
Great, so yes.
Yeah. And,
okay. All right, I look forward to that. Yeah.
A couple of months ago, we published a paper on the Rigel virus, which we examined the number of particles in function resolution. I think it'd be tricky because
it really depends on the choice of the particles. In other words, you can have a lot of particles at certain resolution, but in fact, if you're really, really strict to choose a so-called good particle, you don't really need a lot of particles. So I think a pot like this has to be carefully constructed. Otherwise, it's a bit misleading in general. I think you're probably correct. But I'm just saying, if we want to generalize these principles.
I mean, this is a good point, because I would be surprised that we get the same behavior, no matter what kind of quality criteria you apply. But it could well be that no matter what you do, you always wind up with a straight line, and maybe the slope is different. And I'm just fascinated by this.
Right. Because it depends on the B factor and so on. So.
Richard.
Depends on how the data, the mean amplitude fades out as a function of resolution.
Yes.
And, you know, if you characterize it as a disorder factor, a temperature factor, then, you know, the resolution should go, the number of particles should go as the 1 over d, the log of the number of particles should go as 1 over d squared.
Yes.
And depending on the rate of fade out, which is to do with how good your data is and so on, how disordered your particle is, the slope of that line changes, and that's what we have in that plot. So I think it would be quite good to try and reconcile a completely different way of plotting it with some kind of underlying theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question as well. That's just a comment, really. And that is, you showed some experimental maps, and then once or twice you showed an X-ray map that had been truncated at that resolution. So my question was, in the experimental maps that you showed, how are they presented? Are they sharpened, or do they have a signal-to-noise weighting as a function of resolution? You know, what do you do when you're showing us these maps?
It's a final amplitude adjustment, and it's based on the low-angle scattering data. So there's no B factor or I mean, we could quote a B factor.
If you plot it out, so you've got an empirical factor with many, many parameters that may not be a straight line if plotted as a B factor. But in practice, is it a straight line? And if so, what would the B factor be?
I can't tell you right now. Yeah.
Ed?
I just have a question. There's a tremendous amount of discussion, but perhaps we should take a more sophisticated approach, that reducing resolution to a single scalar may not be the thing we should strive for.
Well,
you could have, two maps where you get the same FSC correlation values in terms of, 0.5, and one has a much flatter, less fall off in high frequencies than the other. So one's going to be vastly...
Isn't that a B factor?
It can be described then as a B factor.
Well, I'm... Yeah. Okay. David?
I had a suggestion. Freeline puts out a point spread function. I thought maybe one idea would be to go to the Rayleigh criterion of putting two point spread functions slide them until you can resolve features the same way Lord Rayleigh did. Because sometimes if you include, you know, very high resolution data, it can be so weak that even weighted up, it doesn't really.
That's the half-wit full maximum.
Half-wit?